Welcome to Authorial Intentions, a series of conversations about recent or forthcoming publications by faculty at Vanderbilt University. I'm Chris Benda, Librarian for Religious Studies and Theology at Vanderbilt University's Divinity Library, and today I'm talking with Laurel Schneider, Professor of Religious Studies, Religion, and Culture here at Vanderbilt, and Thalathia Nikki Young, Vice President for Institutional Equity and Access and Professor of Religion and Gender and Sexuality Studies at Haverford College, about their recent book, Queer Soul and Queer Theology, Ethics and Redemption in Real Life. Thanks again for being willing to be part of this conversation.
Glad to be here.
Thanks for having us.
The title of the book is Queer Soul and Queer Theology. So I wonder if I could start with what you mean by queer.
Laurel, let's hear it. We've had that conversation.
Yeah, we talked about that quite a bit in working on the book, and we both recognize that it's a term that is very malleable in the use of those who use it. So it has many different meanings. It was very important to us to not escape into high theory too far with it. But at the same time, to recognize that queer refers to the demonized and the excluded sexual sort of underbelly of heteronormative culture. So in that sense, it has a lot of possible incarnations in actual bodies, but staying in bodies was also really important to us. You want to add anything to that, Nikki?
I mean, I love that. I also love hearing you talk about this work all over again, my friend. So one of the ways that we tend to talk about queer in our field is as a posture or an orientation or a relation. And I think what Laurel is really good to point out here is that those postures, orientations are value ridden. So we're not just talking about some relation to another thing as odd or as other, but a devaluation, sort of something that needs to be redeemed, which we'll get into later, because it has been mired in not only exclusionary, but a violent effort to malign its isness in relation to the other things around it. So not just other, not just disoriented, not just removed, but removed with a kind of perniciousness. And so that's sort of underwriting what we mean by queer.
Right. And actually, both of the things you said do lead directly to this next question, which gets to the issues of, or the foci of the book on redemption and virtue. Redemption is of course a central concept in Christian theology, carrying along other concepts like sin, perfection, punishment, forgiveness, and so on. And virtue is central to ethics. But your choice of these topics as the focus of the book isn't based simply, I think, on their importance to theology and ethics, but also as a response to the variety of ways in which queer lives are rendered unlivable. So this is a two-part question. First, what are some of the structures and concepts that make queer living difficult, if not impossible? And how do you reconceive redemption and virtue to respond to these structures and concepts?
So, oddly enough, the structures and concepts that make queer lives difficult to be lived have less to do with the queer lives themselves than the narratives and the scripts that we write onto life in general that frame heteronormativity, white cis heteropatriarchy as the most virtuous way of being on earth, right? So the idea of queerness is a result of a long-term commitment to and appreciation of a revaluing of a very narrow mode of being that we build structures and systems to support. And I think to move into the second part of your question, some of our work in the book is about recognizing that We have to rethink both conceptually and in terms of value, the notion of what it means to be queer and othered. So to not rescue, right? So not to lift people, queer people into a place of praise or acceptance or, God forbid, tolerance. It's not that. It's to rethink and revalue, sort of to offer a new understanding of those lies from a perspective that's not like, that's not sort of mediated through a lens of heteronormativity. So my life, let's say, has less and more blurry meaning if I'm only looking at it through a white cishet lens. But if I look at it through the lens that it offers to the world, there's a whole other set of possibilities. And I think Laurel and I were trying to bring that out. What do you think, friend?
Yeah, that's so beautifully said. And I would answer it or add on simply by that, you know, what makes queer lives unlivable in real practical terms is hatred, right? Mm-hmm. Is the many ways in which the narratives that Nikki is pointing to write themselves over the bodies of families, of cultures, of communities that make that life unlivable in the most sort of basic sense of that, of that livable, like, you know, just, but we also want to push further into the word living and the livable as what does it mean to have a full life? Hmm. What is a fuller livingness that allows for a queer life to be livable in a tolerant society, we, I think, would want to say that's still not livability, right? It's there is something that we are attempting to mine out of, in our case, somewhat idiosyncratic attempts to look at lives of queer folk and say, this is not just about the right to exist. Mm. This is that within those lives, there are virtues mm-hmm. that can benefit everyone, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. That come out of that experience that are actually virtues that can be talked about. And we're deliberate going after the term redemption, going after the term. These have been words of murder against queer folk, right? That we are not virtuous, that we are past redemption, we are mm-hmm. unredeemable, according to the logic of white cishet cultural narratives that are deeply woven into our religious traditions. Mm-hmm. So what does it mean to claim those words, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. We're deliberate about that. We have queer folk who are not happy that we're using those words, right? That's and are rightfully a little suspicious. Like, mm-hmm. are we just going to turn the tables and start policing, you know, everyone else like we've been policed? So we're playing with fire a little bit here, and know that we're doing that, trying in a sense to suggest really what we have been taught out of, you know, the wise elders of, you know, of our own studies in feminist and womanist traditions, that reversals actually show us the pernicious aspect of the taken for granted goods, right? Yeah. So we've been working with that to look at this.
Mm-hmm. Great. Oh, well said. Absolutely. Wow.
It's so great to talk to you about
this. I know, I just miss this.
So this is a relatively brief book, but there's a lot in it to ponder and more than we're going to actually be able to talk about today. So as I always say in these interviews, the listeners are going to have to actually read the book. They're not going to get everything from our conversation. And then there are multiple ways I think I could have gone into the book, but I, for the purposes of this conversation, I'm mostly going to follow the book structure with a few exceptions. The structure is basically the book begins with a prelude and ends with a postlude and has two interludes in the middle, like a piece of music or maybe a church service. I don't know. and so we'll come back to a couple of these sections later. The bulk of the book takes up a series of queer virtues, or, I mean, orientations on living. I don't know. Some of which themselves contain other virtues. So we're going to look at each of these virtues in turn, and we won't be able to look at, you know, every single one that comes out in the book. But I hope the conversation will whet listeners' appetites to learn more. So let's start with the first one, which is talking to the dead. And I think when you were talking about elders just a moment ago, Laurel, I think some of the elders are still with us, some elders are not. So what do you mean by talking to the dead? And what does it have to do with redemption as you're understanding it?
This one's on you, Nikki.
So I was trying to, I don't have the book in front of me, funny enough, all my books are still in boxes in the corner. Mm-hmm. But so I was trying to remember the first words of this chapter, but Laurel and I were trying to capture this really nuanced element of queerness as already in a kind of an afterlife, as already presumed dead. And normally when we think about that, it means that people are beyond reachability. Mm. And our effort, I think what we're trying to do in this chapter in talking to the dead, is reposition two things. One, the actual lives of queer folks, right, as not beyond reachability in this key way. And two, to think about it through a sort of theological ethical lens, which is, you know, actually the lines that we're creating between life and death are actually in positions of a really violent structure that eliminates the possibility for us to connect with ancestors or followers or predecessors, mm-hmm. or, you know, our progeny. And these blurred lines, the way that we can blur the lines between people who have gone before us and people who will come after us, helps us to think about our own livability. And we get that from cultures far beyond sort of a Western kind of a American framework that we have, and even the theological framework that we tend to use. So that's the sort of frame of this chapter, both the calling out of queerness as dead, like, you know, not quite that, right? We're pushing against that. And two, calling out the really sort of stark line that we like to draw between life and death, to say, if we touch that line and blur it a little bit, we're doing something really theologically significant that's important for us. And that comes from a variety of spaces. And then using some anecdata to share what that process looks like. Laurel, is that how you remember our process?
I do. And I'll remind you that the chapter begins with Proverbs 18:21. Death and life are in the power of the tongue.
Yes.
We love the multiple valences of that, can we say? but we also, you know, that recognition that death and life, as we are talking about it, it's a much larger concept than you know, who's in a graveyard and who's walking around, right? That the dead are among us in so many ways that require our attention.
Hmm. Yeah.
So in that sense, we're playing with those and pushing on the concept of the dead. So talking to the dead is also, you know, it's very Christian, right? Talking to the outcast, right? Talking to, you know, the Samaritan, you know, on the road. I mean, there are so many ways we can talk about how the violence of the social structures in which we live render, you know, using Judith Butler's notions of the ungrievable, or mm-hmm. the ideas of who is already dead socially, or who is already dead in terms of worth and value. So that's kind of, you know, what does it mean to talk to the dead? Mm-hmm. Right. And we both are, you know, are not satisfied with the simple definitions that, you know, ancestors are gone. So
that's right.
You know, the presence of ancestors in very real ways, who are trying to get our attention in some way or another.
Right. And I think, Laurel, if I may, Laurel's work on the incarnation was really helpful to us during this time and in the writing of this chapter, right? To think about life and death in a kind of binary is both a preclusion against the sexual and gender fluidity that we always want to point to, but also, even within the Christian framework, the narrative of Christian discourse, we have to grapple with the incommensurability of a notion of everlasting life and the reality of, you know, or corporeal, you know, sort of, there are things that will fade. And the way that Laurel grapples with incarnation sort of kind of funds my thinking here in this chapter. I mean, this chapter, I'll go on record and say, was probably the most fun and evocative writing I've done. And certainly couldn't have done it without these really important conversations. So, Laurel, as always, you know, thank you.
Oh, back at you. Back at you. If you can't tell, we loved working together.
Yes.
That's part of the book, I read that section, but I figured you would embody it in the conversation. So, the next chapter is on queer creativity. And it's in your discussion of creativity as transformation that, to me, explicitly ties this virtue to redemption. You talk about the revaluing that makes a dollar out of 15 cents. Is nothing less than the revaluing or redeeming that's at the heart of how you understand redemption. So what are some of the elements of queer creativity? And I was struck by the drag queen Luscious's idea that, quote, long as you're not bothering nobody, hey, you can do what you want, unquote. How is that central to this kind of creativity and to queer living more generally?
Laurel, that's you, my friend. That was your masterpiece.
Yeah. Well, you know, in trying to, this is interesting. The ethicist, Nikki, is so great at talking about the theology, and here I am, the theologian, trying to get at the ethics. I think that you know, one of the things that was kind of wonderful about you know, about listening to Luscious is that sense of the Luscious is a street performer as well, and you know, does beautiful drag work with a drag king, and they go out on the street and they just start talking to people, and they've encountered some hostility, and they've encountered some danger, but in talking about their friendship and the importance of how they support each other. When Luscious says, you know, as long as we're not bothering nobody, you know, then why shouldn't we be outrageous? And now the question of bothering became very interesting to me, and I think has a lot to do with white culture. Luscious is African American, and I think that sense that bothering somebody in the way I was raised was meant that if I was bothering you, that you were somehow upset, right? And that I shouldn't upset you. I shouldn't. So if I'm bothering you, I should stop, right? But what Luscious is pointing to is I'm not interfering with you, right? You can have your feelings. You can have your, but I'm not getting in the way of you being you. I'm not getting in the way of you, you know, and that sense of, you know, of a child who is, you know, in a group of siblings and is, you know, has these older siblings who are, you know, really annoyed by the little child, and the mother who comes and says, you know, she's not bothering you, right? Go on about your business. She's not bothering you, when they're annoyed. So making this distinction between being annoyed and being truly hated, right, or being truly attacked. Now that's bothering somebody. Murder is bothering somebody, right? And so how we define this, I think, when we live in a culture that is dominated by one view of who gets to feel okay about life, right? Who gets to not be bothered in that, what I'm going to call that sort of white middle class sense of not being bothered. That means that everybody else has to deal with whatever bothers them, but gets to be legislated against. Do you see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So what Luscious says, I think, points to the possibility of rethinking what being in a civil society of true diversity means. It means getting annoyed. It means getting, you know, like, I don't like you. You're bothering me in that sense. Mm-hmm. But not to allow for the possibility of civil bothering. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that Luscious, you know, isn't going to offend some people, right? For whatever reason that they think that that's wrong. But as long as Luscious isn't harming them, and that's, I think, that's what we're kind of trying to point to, that creativity, queer creativity, is this ability to be outrageous, is this ability to sort of produce in camp and in all kinds of other ways, a sort of mirror for society and a way of thinking about ourselves differently or seeing some of the limitations of that might be troublesome, mm-hmm. right? Might be, you know, I might not like it, but I'm not, you know, I'm not being strung up by the thumbs. Yeah. Right. So we start making these kinds of distinctions, especially, mm-hmm. you know, especially of trans women of color is just, you know, at the epidemic level, and that's being documented now. We really need to talk about who's bothering who. Mm-hmm. I can get on the soapbox about that right now.
As you should. Yeah. Well, and I think, you know, Laurel's chapter, I mean, these are our chapters, but this is Laurel's conceptual sort of, was that the nexus of the concept here?
You're outing us.
And I'll say that I remember where we were when we had this conversation. I remember what it looked like in the room. And there was something about like curating queer livability without the worry that it would harm someone else's existence was the frame, right? So this queer creativity that you're talking about. And I love the use of Luscious in this because of the current use of the language of bother, right? So right now, most people, especially younger folks, if you're talking to them, they're using bother in the sense of like a reflective modifier. So I am not bothered, or I'm not bothered by so-and-so. It's like a thing that people say. And what Luscious, I think, is captivating, and what Laurel could see in advance, is that this sort of space of being bothered is not going to cramp, or shouldn't cramp, someone's style of making a livable life. And that queer creativity has been doing that long before, in its entire existence. Mm. And that is actually aligned with the very beautiful, at least the way that we're trying to, you know, divine process of making, right? Like that is itself a divine kind of action. And I lived in that chapter. I just loved it.
Well, when we think about redemption as a form, we talk about redeeming, right? Mm-hmm. Revaluing, but also, you know, redemption in a more conceptual, in a more conventional sense of healing, right? Mm-hmm. To be healed of something, so that if we can recognize how the many and varied and wonderfully odd ways that queer folk the world over for eons have expressed themselves in ways that small and large heal, you know, heal the wound, heal the rift, in their souls or in their intimate relations. And so that capacity to find healing that doesn't bother nobody.
Yeah. You know? Exactly.
And for me, bother means, you know, it's a pretty high bar for bother. I have to learn how to, you know, how to handle all the petty botherings, you know, all the ways that I'm not supposed to feel bad about anything. And we have a lot of students now for whom, you know, a certain expectation that their learning isn't supposed to bother them. Mm. You know, their learning isn't supposed to raise painful issues. And we have to struggle with that as teachers, especially teachers in the realm of religion and ethics, you know, of how to help folk know that a livable life means also learning how to make a distinction between harm and bother.
Absolutely.
Know, kind of that and sometimes it's a very clear line. There aren't simple ways of parsing that necessarily, but we need a better understanding of that difference because otherwise we cannot live in a diverse society. Otherwise we can't live in a queer friendly world. We just can't unless we have that kind of distinction.
Agreed. I mean, this is the slippage between students using language like I was attacked in my class, when really what someone did was share an opinion that was different from their own. And we have to essentially do the work of cultivating emotional intelligence that allows students to have responsibility for their own feelings as they're processing new information. And there was a period where we didn't care about that. And then there was a period where we cared too much. And now what we're trying to do is sort of navigate that. And I think, our book actually in calling for a redeeming, a revaluing of persons in their bodies and in their experience of life is also a way to call people to, I'm sorry, own your own shit around my existence, you know, like, so. Yeah.
Well, thank you for mentioning bodies because I think that's what we want to turn to now is the virtue of, being oneself fully and erotically in one's body, embodiedness. And you focus on, both of you focus on skin, breath, touch, which have been taken in various ways, of course, and not always affirming ways, as you discuss in the chapter. How do you redeem embodiedness and how do you do it in a way that avoids the dualisms and some of the other practices that have made the body, especially the queer body, problematic to some?
I'd love to start with this in a short way. I think Laurel and I had a different start. We just weren't willing to start from that initial body-mind gap problem. Like, we didn't start there. So I think when we were trying to live into the embodied piece of this work, it was to assume that we are located in the flesh always already. And so to talk about that location is really important and central to thinking about queerness, as opposed to there is a certain kind of selfhood that requires us to define it through body, mind, spirit, mind, body. Like, we just didn't start there. Laurel, would you say that, do you remember it that way?
Yeah, I do. I do remember it that way. And I think that, you know, sometimes if you start with something like that, you end up getting trapped in it. And and so to be able to bring together stories, because that's a lot of what we do in this, is to try to bring stories in to, you know, to sort of illustrate what we're getting at. And you know, you're writing a book, it's awfully hard to, you know, to do that without slipping into the disembodied, right?
Yeah.
Because there is something about a book itself that isn't, you know, we're not looking at bodies, or we're not touching bodies, we're touching the body of the book. So we're always talking about it. And we can't really get around that, but I think what we were trying to do was to point toward and to start from, as Nikki says, and then to point also toward, you know, the idea that we are, our very thoughts are bodies. You know, we are not disembodied in our work together. In fact, being together was a really important part of the work. We didn't do much of this work apart from each other. So that, anyway, I'm getting off track, but I think it's, you know, it's a tangle, know, it's a tangle in the process of the work that we were doing. But we did keep reminding each other to come back to that. I mean, it was in one way or another, there would be a sort of question of, you know, how does this relate to an actual experience or an actual story or...
Yeah. Another example of this, Chris, I think to Laurel's last point is that when I'm remembering parts of this book, I'm remembering things like what it felt like in there. We have an entire file that's the name of the place that we were when we were, right? So there's an embodied element to the process of the book that we're, I think, trying to capture in that chapter, to say that the ways that we're making meaning of the world and the world makes meaning of us happens through and in our bodies. And those vectors that we're naming, our skin, et cetera, they are modes of that meaning making, but not the sole location, like by themselves. So we're really trying to navigate, I think, the sort of elements of how the world has been written onto our bodies, and also how we make meaning. And it also shows up in the process of the book. Like I can remember what I was eating, or, you know, maybe after this interview, Laura will tell you about some squirrel pelts, right? So, so there are some things that come out in the process here. So we're trying to do in the book what we were experiencing too.
Wow. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Two queer friends, you know, biracial pair of us caught out in the woods, of Pensatucky. And we had to be rescued.
Yeah. Oh wow.
Yeah.
And you don't want to share this for posterity?
I don't know. Let's just say that it was late at night and we were far away from other people and things.
And in the woods and unable to get into a structure. And yeah, it was it was a kind of the worst of an Airbnb experience, or you know, writing retreat. Yeah. So but we survived. We survived.
We did, to tell the story.
Right.
So not quite a scandal, but your next chapter was is a chapter on scandal and improvisation. A set of virtues, I guess. You call them linked queer virtues, and that chapter for me, as someone who has sort of a biblical studies background, I was intrigued by the lengthy section you had on Paul, Saint Paul. So I had a couple of questions on this chapter. One is just how are Paul's remarks on the scandal of Christ crucified generative for your discussion of scandal and improvisation? And then sort of the broader question, given some of your other uses of the Bible, the encounter between God and Moses at the burning bush, Jesus raising Lazarus, and so on, in what ways do both of you, a Christian theologian and an ethicist, view the Bible as a resource for the work that you're doing?
I think, Chris, you're pointing to a really interesting confrontation that we both had in terms of our vocation and writing related to this text, which is to say that I was doing more theology than I thought I would be as an ethicist, and Laurel was doing more ethics. And both of us, I think, were doing much more biblical speak than we imagine. Now, I keep tripping my way into this scenario. The previous book that I wrote is basically a biblical studies book that I was writing as an ethicist. And I was like, what's happened to me? So I think in this context, what we want it to grapple with are the stories and the reimaginings of Paul and other biblical sort of motifs as a way for us to understand queer bodies and people and experiences that was fairly common to us. I mean, these are stories. I mean, the burning bush. I mean, all of these things are pretty at the ready in terms of stories. But the way that we were reading them and making meaning of them, we hoped was mirroring, or we hope to show that it mirrors the way that queer folks and queer engagement with text and material happens as a kind of a counter narrative, a counter public that's not necessarily subversive. It's just unheard or untold or unvalued or undervalued, at least. So there's nothing particularly, not to take anything away from us, but there's nothing particularly special about what we're saying in relation to those texts. It's to say that there's an entirely different way to read this. And if we use just a slightly different lens with some other priorities, look at what worlds we open up. Look at a new way to think about what Paul is trying to do in this scenario, and how scandalous is our reusing of Paul? How scandalous is such an investment? Mm-hmm. But I will say that coming up with scandal for this was the second most fun thing that happened, I think, to realize scandal was this, you know, kind of dirty, but not so dirty way of entering relationship with the text. Laura, mm-hmm. what do you think?
Yeah, and you know, I too thought it was really fun, and I too found myself going, "Wow, what are we doing?" But you know, but because we were using stories, and you know, and we were using queer stories, it you know, given our training, given our traditions, biblical stories are in there too, right? Mm-hmm. And biblical stories have been used against us, and some of the ways in which, you know, queer theologians, biblical scholars, and ethicists have found the need to not disavow the Bible, but to reclaim it in certain ways. But that wasn't really the task of the book. We weren't trying to save the Bible. We weren't trying to, you know, we're not trying to do any of that. But it was really kind of, you know, to think about scandal, because we both came to the topic of scandal as, you know, as central to the experience of queer people.
That's right.
You know, scandal and sex seem to be intimately linked, and wherever there's sex and trouble, queer stuff is not far behind, right? So it's in there. And then, you know, and I found myself thinking about the scandal of the cross. Mm-hmm. You know, I was like, wait a minute, that's like there's something there. There's something about the scandal. I first went to Luther, but then I went to Paul, right? And we started talking about Paul and the scandal of the cross, and what Paul does. If you go back to that letter in Corinthians, where he's talking about that, you know, we found ourselves reading it as I say in the book. In fact, I have it right here. He understood that the execution of his divine savior by crucifixion, a criminal sentence, looked like and was a disgrace to common decency and dominant norms. Well, does that sound queer or not? Mm-hmm. Right? The disgrace to dominant norms and decency. And it was God's confounding departure from the standard rules of order, hierarchy, and power for humans and deities that was important to Paul. So in other words, God's action, or what Paul is calling God's action, the scandal of the cross, is a, you know, is an affront to the dominant norms. Mm. And that's what makes it scandalous, right? So that Jesus should die a criminal, that God should die a criminal, is an affront to all of the standards of decency of the
Absolutely.
Time, right?
That's right.
That's what we deal with.
It's the queerest thing. And it's not like, you know, Jesus was laying somewhere quiet by himself, but that this death was so visible and it was so embodied. The things that we tell about Jesus on the cross have to do with Jesus's body specifically. Mm-hmm. So this is a scandal of the decency of him being disrobed, that there's piercing, that we're seeing all of this, that there's marring of the skin, of the flesh that is visible. It's a part of our what do you call it when you're looking at something? It's a part of the gaze. It's a part of the gaze that is itself reflective of a kind of queer approach. Like, you know, like the ways that we violate queer bodies, basically. They're objects of gaze. They are objects of our violence, and that doing so saves the sort of cultural narrative of decency. Right. Right. Mm-hmm. So that the public marring of bodies is an effort to, you know, manifest the safety and security of normativity. Like, literally, that's what's happening. So for us, you couldn't avoid at least highlighting, you know, Paul's reading of Paul's work in this letter as particularly scandalous. I loved it. And I also was thinking about our work with just sort of thinking about some of the words that we had up there. You know, we had gone in the direction of humor in this really important way. We had gone in the direction of story and of like I think bawdiness, right? Like really raucous types of words. And I think taking a step back and realizing the whole thing is scandalous. There's no way to tell this Christian narrative without it being steeped in a parallel version of what's happening to and in queer bodies and lives.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Over against the triumphalist narrative.
Right? Exactly.
So that's the kind of, you know, pulling back the, you know, the ornate royal robes of the church's gloss over what is a scandalous story. And, you know, and you've got a lot of mainstream old-timey theologians saying that. It's just where does it get lived? So
I wanted to actually talk a little bit about the interludes right now, which actually fall between the chapters on embodiment and on scandal and improvisation. The first interlude is Laurels. I mean, it's not named as Laurels, but it's Laurels. It focuses on open spaces, specifically your wedding ceremony with Emily. And the second is Nikki's, again, not named that way, but focusing on the question of home and demarcations, symbolized by a fence. So in some ways, you've already talked a little bit about working together, but I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about working together on a book as two people coming together and working on a book. And also, more specifically, with regard to these chapters, why these chapters and why are they interludes? Why are they where they are? Without giving away too much. I mean, maybe we want readers to come to their own conclusions. But
well, so here's one thing that I loved about our process and that I'm sad that I'll probably never experience again. So we told each other so many stories in the writing of this book, many stories, obviously, that aren't in the book, but we learned about one another through experiences that we shared, through meals that we had, through the sharing of stories. And I think those stories, for me, made us more queer in one another's eyes, made us more normative in one another's eyes as well, right? So we use these really normative things, right, in the interludes here to illustrate. I mean, look at what we're talking about, an institution marriage and home buying, right? Very sort of mid-century capitalist kinds of things to do to illustrate the queer frame. And we did that, Chris, over and over and over in our time together. So we couldn't, I don't think we could avoid letting that be a part of the book, which is to say that when you redeem, where you revalue, retell, and re-understand a kind of narrative and a set of lives through a slightly different lens, look at the new meaning that it has. I mean, and I think that's what the interludes did, at least in my mind. Laurel, I'd love to hear what you have to say about it.
I'm just so glad to hear you put it that way. I love that. I don't have anything to add to that. It really, we did tell each other so, and we experienced things about each other and each other's families. You know, that was really important to the living out, you know, of the work in ways that we probably will continue to unpack forever, you know,
forever.
Some of the really amazing moments that we had that aren't amazing, right? It's not like, woo, big amazing, but it was more the amazement. When I say amazing, I just mean really real.
You know,
a really real aspect to that. So yeah, I think the way you put it, Nikki, is absolutely right. And in terms of placement, I think we were just trying to make it sort of, you correct me if I'm not remembering, Nikki, but I think we just kind of wanted them spread out. So it was like, here were our chapters, and the interludes came later, and we just sort of let them decide where they wanted to be.
Yeah.
They just sort of dropped in, right?
I think that's Exactly right. And it mirrors how the thought process, the sort of theorizing and theologizing that we were doing, mixed with the stories. I mean, it's sort of parallel. I think you're absolutely right. They fit where they fit.
Yeah. And we had a reason for starting with the prelude we started with and ending with the postlude.
That we did.
But that was more deliberate in terms of placement, but the interludes were,
they just kind of fell
and they decided where they wanted
to be. I feel badly that I asked you this question and didn't think about, I mean, that is what Nikki said was just, it was like, oh yeah.
Yeah. Really beautiful.
How did I not see this?
Really, yeah. Well, no, don't feel badly about it. These are the, hopefully these are the things that people will discover in the reading too. Right.
Right.
Or not, you know, and it's just there. It's just, it's in the, you know, it's in the fabric, but it's not necessarily explicit.
Right.
Yeah. We didn't attempt to make those things explicit.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you have a couple more chapters following the interludes on other virtues, one of which is queer relations. So I wanted to ask you about those chapters as well. Queer relations identifies several queer virtues related to relationality, to a relationality that redeems. And it also insists on several, didn't quite know what to call them, other things like truth-telling, celebration of desire, health, resistance to abuse, care and protection of the vulnerable, and attention to the multifarious possibilities of human ways of being fulfilled together. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the various virtues that go into making queer relations a reality, and also about how these actions like truth-telling and such relate to those virtues.
I'll just start out by saying, you know, what, as soon as you get into the question of queer relationality, you're stepping into, you know, you're just stepping into a wonderful kaleidoscope of possibility. And what we didn't want to do, what we were very, very clear that we didn't want to set up a set of rules that would further constrain possibilities. That we're both so aware of the, you know, the late capitalist dimensions of the of the institution of marriage, for example, and how constraining that can be to especially, you know, in this era in which, you know, there are a lot of ways in which marriage is just a holdover that doesn't do what it's supposed to do. And how many of us are experimenting with or refusing that conformity, that we didn't want to get into just because the two of us actually live in really pretty conventional relationships, right? And, you know, we could be in the 50s pretty easily, you know? And so, at least on that level, not on other levels, but on that level. And so to, you know, to really be conscious of, you know, of our own cisgendered, you know, conventionality in our lives. And yet what we're wanting to point to is that there are incredible virtues emerging and that have always emerged, but have been hidden from this links to creativity, from the relational creativity of queer folk, and how to develop relations that don't conform to this standardized structure. But that, so we had to ask ourselves, well, are there yet virtues within that we can? And I don't think we're doing anything particularly radical in this chapter, you know, by saying truth telling is central, right? So tell the truth about what you're doing, you know, with those that matter. So, you know, don't be lying about it, you know, unless your life is at stake, but don't be lying about it. And don't be, so kind of some basic, you know, kind of basic, here's how to be a mature adult in a relationship.
Yeah.
Whatever the form of that relationship is, without getting into that easy slide into a conformity of the, you know, of the nuclear family, you know, thing. Mm-hmm. And not to dismiss that either, because we both live it. But, you know, but at the same time, to just have some ways of suggesting that most of us can learn, you know, from the polyamorous, you know, adventures of, you know, of some queer folk. So many of us can learn from the, you know, from the ways in which relationships come in and out of people's lives in ways that have integrity, have even, you know, have rituals of beginning and ending in ways that are just so rich and deep and health giving and, you know, and kind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that we don't pay attention to because they don't follow these conventional patterns, and we don't even see and still have to be hidden because of all kinds of moralizing over what is the right sort of relationship. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and then when, you know, as, you know, as some queer theorists have pointed to the ways that children are used to create greater conformity to forms that are not necessarily good for children, you know, and when you bring a race analysis into the ways in which healthy Black children have been raised by non-conforming family situations that have been in some cases forced upon those families, and yet you have these amazing results, and yet to say somehow that non-conforming structure is somehow bad for children, right? Well, what is really bad for children? We can talk about what's bad for children, and it's probably not non-conforming structures of family. It's other things that go wrong in relation to that are bad for children. So now we don't really get into that in this chapter, but that's a whole area that gets used against queer folk in terms of the relationship of queerness to children as a weapon, that children are weaponized in relation to queer folk. When it comes to relationality, when it comes to acceptable forms of relation.
Mm-hmm. I think Laurel is capturing it. I mean, honestly, this chapter, as Laurel says, we're not doing anything radical. We're saying that the way that we typically pay attention to relationship values and virtues is by situating them within a context of a very specific and limited outcome. So for example, because we want people to be together, if they're in a romantic context, we want people to be together forever, no matter what. So the values that we hold up are things like loyalty, stability, safety, security, right? Or we want people to maintain a sort of respectability. So we value things like, you know, you don't hang out your laundry, so discretion, et cetera, right? So those are virtues that emerge all the time. And what we wanted to offer was like, well, to what end? What if our end, instead of being a sort of a colonizing set of relationships that marks our bodies and our personhoods as always belonging to another without accountability, what if instead we're thinking about things like, well, you know, if we're telling the truth and we're able to situate our desires front and center, and we're able to find, you know, mutually beneficial modes of joy, and we have accountability, the end to which we're orienting is something like liberation, not stability. If stability is an end, you do all these other things.
And not bothering anybody.
In some ways, it's like a simplifying of things. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're kind of going to like certain fundamentals, and after that, you know, whatever. But here are some of the fundamentals that you're laying down.
Yeah, I mean, that's after that, it's a script.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay. I think I have time for one more, friends, before
okay,
I have a
yes,
3 o'clock. But you all can finish. I just
Well, and the I wanted to talk a little bit about the chapter on queer transformational epistemologies, which you were talking about the book being disembodied in some ways. This chapter struck me as the most disembodied of all of the chapters in the book. But I mean, that's not to say that it didn't have value. I just saw it as sort of an abstract summation of what you've been presenting less abstractly But since you're here, you can verify or contest what I'm saying. I mean, how did you see this particular chapter?
This is complicated, so I'm very curious about what Laurel is going to say. But I will say that one of the things that our book helped us to do was to know differently, to know queerness, queer selves, queer bodies differently, and to speak about them. So we were, throughout the book, learning how to frame something. We were redeeming for ourselves the stories that we've heard, stories that we've shared, things that we've witnessed on TV, are part of our histories. And we did want to take a step back and have a bird's eye view of, what has shifted about our knowing? And what does that say about how we come to know and articulate that knowledge to people who aren't always hearing our stories or sharing stories with one another? What does that mean sort of in a philosophical sense? And so this chapter for me is about shifting our attention to, you know, the process of coming to know and to value is itself something we need to take a look at as a sort of a queer mode of gazing differently, of articulating differently, right? So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, you know, just the word epistemology, you know, that's gonna be your first clue. That, you know, but how does all of this lead to a process of learning? You know, how do we learn? How do we know what we know, and how do we learn? And I'm curious that you found it disembodied. I was leaping through it, you know, and I'm not sure I agree.
Okay.
Because it, you know, it starts with actually a story from my own experience in junior high school, following a girl down the hallway. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Up in the bathroom, beating myself for desiring her. And there are some other kind of stories in it that, but we are trying to bring some conceptual hooks in here, you know, to say, really to kind of point to further possibilities for the work.
Yeah.
I think the question of queer epistemology that come, you know, if what we've outlined is persuasive, then it is a next step to say, how do we build knowledge around this? Mm-hmm. What are the ways of knowing? What do we use to judge experiences that can be virtuous? Mm. Right? What are the elements of virtue? Because we've used experiences to suggest virtues, but that can be problematic in the long run, and that's why the question of what, you know, how we know what we know, epistemology becomes important.
Mm-hmm.
But we were also, it was the pandemic and we were tired, and it was kind of like, okay, I think we've done what we need to do here. But it's a really short chapter,
right?
It's way too short for the topic. So I think my own hope has been that someone who reads it would be like, oh,
let me pick this up.
This is not enough. We got to work on this. And that's precisely my hope.
Right. Yeah. So.
Right. Well, and I think it's to me, it says something that you have all of these virtue chapters first, and then you end with the epistemological reflection, or the taking it to a different level.
The knowledge has to come out of those experiences, not the other way around.
Yeah.
Even though epistemology is a kind of circle, it's not simple in that way. But
right.
You know, we'll never have that period of time that we had again. There were all sorts of factors that came into it, and knock on wood, we won't experience global and personal tragedies at the degree to which we did during that time again. But I do think that what you hopefully, Chris, got, and what some readers might pull out of this, is what we were trying to say at a very specific time in our lives about what it means to be and to think queerly. And for us, it was about making our way, even when we were tired or in a lot of pain or filled with a lot of anxiety, frankly, that even when we were tired, this is how we were trying to make our way. And we refuse to die in that space. And I'm, you know, I was redeemed for it. And you know, so.
Amen. Yeah.
So we'll just do the last two questions.
Okay.
I wanted to ask you about the prelude and the postlude, which to me described a trajectory from the approaching end of life to the approaching beginning of life. So it's an interesting progression. And the identities of the speakers in these chapters are even less clear than the interludes to me. To me, the ending of the prelude suggests the difficulty in ultimately changing one's views. Even when someone becomes more accepting as they get older, their embodiment can sabotage them. Whereas the postlude, by contrast, ends with an affirmation of the miraculous, challenging heteronormative views of the creation of new life. So my questions for you are, was your obscuring of speaker identities part of a larger intention for these two sections? And how do you see these sections commenting on one another?
Well, first of all, I really want to appreciate the fact that you really saw what we were doing, you know, with the prelude being about end of life and the postlude about the beginning of life. I'm really gratified that you picked up on that as something that might have been intentional, because it was. And the obscuring of the names, we just felt so much that, and I can say something about how we wrote the book. Every other thing I've worked on that has involved other authors get chunks and they do their chunk, right? Mm-hmm. We didn't do this way. We wrote the entire thing. We brainstormed the topics, and then we assigned each other topics. We broke those up between each other, and our assignment to each other was to write approximately 10 pages on that topic. And then we traded. And we were to treat the 10 pages we got as something we'd written, but might need our, you know, like the way you go back over something, and to expand. So inevitably, it was a wonderful way, partly because we trusted each other so much, it was a wonderful way to totally integrate our voices. And one of the things that I love about how some people have read this is that they can't tell who did what, or who, you know, for example, a reader might think, well, all of the illustrations that involve black folks must have come from Nikki, or all of the examples that involve white folks must have come from Laurel. Well, no, that's in fact not true. And we like that fact, you know, that it's just the writing itself, the whole process that we engaged in, our fun with it, had that quality. So it seemed weird at the end to then say, "Oh, I'm going to put my name on this. I'm going to put, you know, or you're going to put your name on that." Even though it is true, the prelude and the postlude and the two interludes, we didn't pass back to each other. We shared, and it all started with the postlude. Nikki shared that with me, and I was like, oh, we have to use that. We have to find a way to use that. And so I've just said who wrote the postlude, which doesn't matter. We don't need people not to know. Just didn't particularly, it seemed a little jarring to put our names on it when everything else. You know, so then, you know, the prelude, you know, is about me and my father. And the effect, you know, of his growing dementia. And that was a really powerful thing for me to write, you know, and I wasn't sure about including it. You know, but Nikki was like, oh yeah. And then as we thought about it, because I hadn't planned on doing an end of life thing, it just seemed like that was a really good way. And I particularly appreciate what you've picked out of the prelude that, you know, it's hard to change, you know, and embodiment gets in the way, you know, embodiment can get in the way of change, in some very real ways, and how we have to live with that, right? We have to, you know, what is the redemption of that moment? Well, for me, you know, it was to, I'm going to choke up, but for me, it was to use his phrase, you know, saying goodbye to him, use his own phrase. And that for me was a, you know, was a kind of way of accepting a limitation, right? And that's what we've got to do with each other. You know, we do have to accept limitations, which again kind of goes back to bothering.
Right,
you know?
Exactly. Yeah.
Like, okay, like, you know, I could have gotten all outraged. I could have gone back into my youthful self and been like, you know, you homophobe, you. No, not in that. Not in, you know, not in that case. Not given what had, you know, what it meant.
Right.
So, yeah. It you know, it seemed like putting our names on them, I mean, they are very personal stories, but also putting our names on them would also potentially limit somebody reading it and recognizing something of their own story in one or the other of them or both of them, right? That that's, yeah, you know, there's that thing of don't be anonymous or be anonymous in a way or, so,
right.
Yeah.
Well, and so I want to end with a question about soul.
Yeah, that's right. Since, that's an important question.
Since the book is called Queer Soul and Queer Theology, so I looked in the books index and soul doesn't appear. I did a search for the word soul in an e-version of the book where it only appears once, and that's not necessarily in a good place because it's a critique of the separation of the body and the spirit. So that made me think there's something more going on here.
Thank you for that generous reading. Thank you for that. That's a very generous interpretation.
So my theorizing was to see a parallelism between the title, Queer Soul and Queer Theology, and the subtitle, The Ethics and Redemption in the subtitle, and to wonder if soul isn't another way of talking about queer virtues. So the soul of real lives lived in, through, and with the divine. But since I have an author here, I'm...
No, that I love that. I love that. I think that's right. And we need to write that into the book. No, you know, it's. I'm a little embarrassed that, you know, it's not even in the index. And it's not even... And part of it is, you know, our title came last. And the publisher wanted a different title, and we had a back and forth over over Queer Soul, and part of that is, you know, our publisher's British, at least this is my assumption, that and that what they really, they're like, okay, if you're gonna have that, then at least you should pluralize it, Queer Souls, and we were like, no, thinking, missing the point about the function of soul, and, you know, thinking about Black culture, thinking about the ways in which we can talk about soul, you know, so soul theology, soul ethics, and I think you put your finger on it. You know, it is this link to suggesting that taken collectively, these virtues that we're lifting up indicate a kind of soul, right? Indicate a soul dimension to queer life, or at least a soul dimension that we're wanting to name as such for queer lives. So it's not queer souls, you know, it's not about individuals, it's not about some, and you know, they were uncomfortable with the word soul altogether, so we had to, you know, we had to and we won on keeping it the way we wanted, but we were wanting to just name it Queer Soul. So we, it was a concession to say and queer theology. Yeah. And for them that was about marketing, but you know, they made the book so stupidly expensive, it's, you know, it just really is frustrating. We actually tried to get it open access. We even pulled the money together when Nikki was still at Bucknell, and I was able to, and even then the publisher sort of just ghosted us on that, and I get it, they needed to get as much money as possible, but we're still hoping to get it somehow onto open access. So that, and maybe now they've sold as much as they're going to sell at the ridiculous price. Thank God for libraries getting e-copies of it. I think that's a huge plus for people, because we want, you know, we want this to be accessible.
Want to
we want people to read it. You know, so I hope that we, I'm going to try to climb that mountain again with the publisher. But so,
well, good luck.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
So, Laurel and Nikki, thank you again for this conversation. Again, I've been talking with Laurel Schneider, professor of religious studies, religion, and culture here at Vanderbilt, and Thalathia Nikki Young, vice president for institutional equity and access, and professor of religion and gender and sexuality studies at Haverford College, about their recent book, Queer Soul and Queer Theology, Ethics and Redemption in Real Life, published by Routledge as part of the series Routledge New Critical Thinking in Religion, Theology, and Biblical Studies. If you have any comments about this conversation, just browse to the homepage of the Vanderbilt Divinity Library and click on the Ask a Librarian link on that page, or send me an email at chris.benda@vanderbilt.edu. We look forward to hearing from you, and thanks for listening.